Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross, hanging out with you. It is, as we record this, a Sunday evening, and not a half bad one after a really hot day. How's everything in New York, Rob?
It's been beautiful the last 4.5 days. We had almost 90-degree weather on Thursday. Friday was an interesting mixed bag because it was a bit overcast, which kept it from being too hot.
Yeah.
But when I left work in the afternoon, it was just magnificent. And yesterday, we were out and about with the windows down and the radio on and, you know, doing grocery shopping in that kind of a climate was okay by me. And the drivers didn't drive me crazy and people in the supermarket didn't irritate me like they usually do. So a great weekend, relaxing all around, with the exception of watching the New York Mets disintegrate before my eyes, which is just as stunning it is as a shame because of the fast jump out of the gate that they had. That was, well, it was stunning and wonderful for those of us who are fans of the Mets. And I have to say, once again, I pin it directly on another situation caused by Matt Harvey, who has now, in fact, been designated for assignment and released by the Mets. Or they may trade him, I don't know, but I think it'll be a release and let him catch on somewhere else and good luck. But a very sad situation and something that he caused a cancer in the clubhouse. And I think that the rot has set in and the Mets need to regroup, regather themselves, and reevaluate who they are and where they're going, because they certainly were on the right path as the season began. And they've now lost something like 7 in a row and slipped to second place.
Well, and how is it that they're losing the games? Because I only get to see them every so often from here. So are they losing the games because of pitching? Are they giving up too many runs? Or is it just a matter of they can't score?
It's both.
Oh, really? It's
beyond Jacob deGrom and Noah Syndergaard, who've suddenly stumbled themselves and now Jacob deGrom is on the 10-day disabled list with a hyperextended elbow. The starting pitching has been plagued by the fact that once you get past deGrom and Syndergaard, you don't have much to go with. Harvey was completely unproductive, period, while he was starting. He was moved to the bullpen, and even worse there, but that was also because he didn't want to go. And you have to remember, this was a guy who was all about himself. He was not of the team. So no matter what the pundits may say, I felt that he deliberately sabotaged any chances he could possibly have of coming back to the rotation by not being productive out of the bullpen.
Yeah.
The bullpen itself right now has suddenly stumbled in that they can't seem to get a third out. Case in point, last night it was a 1-0 game in the 9th inning, and the bullpen managed to give up another run, which led the Mets to complete futility. The scoring has been a question mark because you have men on base with less than two outs and you can't get them in. You know, Friday night's game, the Mets made a comeback. They were down 8-2, and suddenly in the bottom of the ninth, they were down 8-7 with the winning run on second base, the tying run on third, and one out. And they couldn't bring that last run in because they're all swinging for the fences, and that's not wise. All you need to do is poke a single in. That will get you runs.
Right, get hits. And that's the problem is with the Cardinals right now. They've had similar issues, and it's not so much. I mean, they've had guys who have been hot and cold as far as hitting is concerned, but that always happens, and you have to be ready for that. The real problems have been pitching. The starting pitching is adequate, where in the past the Cardinals have been very lucky to have great starting pitching over time. And the bullpen has kind of ebbed and flowed as time has gone on. Right now, they have just adequate starting pitching and the bullpen has been shaky. So they're not winning a lot of games. And in fact, they're losing a lot of games in extra innings in like the 11th, the 12th, the 13th. And they just got some really bad news over the last couple of days because one of the most solid players on the team over the last decade has been the catcher, Yadier Molina. The guy's a perennial all-star.
And he's hurt hits and broken hearts so many times, I've lost count.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
but I've seen the video of what you were telling me about.
Oh.
The thing is, when I looked at it, and you can explain it in a moment, but when you look at it, you've seen this kind of thing before, but my first thought was, Please tell me he was wearing a cup.
That, and you know what? That has been the question of the last couple of days here in St. Louis is, was Yachty in fact wearing a cup? Because it didn't look like it. And he had to undergo emergency surgery. It was, as you said, it was a fairly common thing where it was a foul tip that didn't even hit the ground. It just barely changed trajectory when it came off the bat, but it was enough to go under Yachty's glove and hit him right in the balls. And unfortunately, it did enough damage that he had to be rushed off to the hospital. He had emergency surgery. They said an undisclosed surgery. I think we can probably make the leap that he had to have at least one of them removed, because it probably just disintegrated. But, it's one of those, it's going to keep him out of the lineup for a month. And as if the Cardinals needed one more hit, one of their best players is now on the DL for who knows how long. It's going to happen, what kind of moves they're going to make to try to shore up the fact that Yachty's not there. Good question. How do you take one of the best players on your team and just say, okay, we'll plug somebody in?
Well, here's the interesting thing. One, he on it's sort of a mirror of the Mets situation because Harvey was a cancer. Yadier Molina has been the heartbeat
right.
of that team.
Yep.
So that takes away your commander, The other thing is that like the Mets, now their main catcher is gone. I mean, the Mets lost both catchers, one for the season without question, and they've got to get rid of him once and for all because Travis d'Arnaud went down early in the season with an arm injury that now calls for, of all things, Tommy John surgery. Okay, and he's a catcher. Kevin Plawicki was hit by a pitch, so he's got a broken hand. He'll be back in a short amount of time, but right now they're using two catchers that they had to get up from the minor leagues, one of them being Jose Lobaton, who's a cast-off from the Washington Nationals. And that hurts right there in and of itself when you don't have an everyday catcher that you know and who knows and works with the pitchers and, this pitcher uses this catcher, this pitcher uses that catcher, So that does put a kind of a pallor on how the Cardinals go forward.
Right.
But the interesting thing that I was going to say about the Mets quandary is the fact that they're going through right now what everybody else certainly in the Eastern Division went through. I mean, the Braves couldn't win a game. The Phillies couldn't win a game. The Nationals couldn't win a game. Now you've got a race because the Nationals have won something like six or seven in a row. The Phillies had won seven in a row. The Braves have gone right into first place. The Phillies and the Braves don't have any stars. They're both very young teams still in the rebuilding process that have made strides beyond anybody's expectations. So the Mets really need to focus on what they've got because they've got the weapons. They've got a good mix and balance of young players and older seasoned veterans. And they really just need to, focus, forget what happened, forget this row of losses, and get back to that mindset that they had when they went on that eight-game winning streak to open the season.
Right. Well, and as we move away from baseball and into hockey, the one good news that we got today, or one piece of good news that we got today, is that the Boston Bruins are out of the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Tampa Bay Lightning beat them in, I believe it was six games, and we'll move on to the Eastern Conference Finals. And so, good. Boston's out, Tampa's in, and it remains to be seen. I saw another terrible collapse out of the Nashville Predators the other night. So I don't know how long they are for this world, but maybe they can put it back together. There's still time. And Vegas continues to cruise.
Vegas is certainly having their moments because they were leading 3-0 going into the third period the other night, and the final score was 6-3.
Right.
So how San Jose managed to come back and tie it up, I'm presuming, would be beyond me. But, I would like to see Vegas finish them off. And I certainly would like to see Nashville take out Winnipeg. And I, that first goal should have been disallowed. The first goal that was scored last night by Winnipeg to give it a 1-0 lead, unacceptable. The officiating in the NHL is just dreadful.
Right.
It really is. So that's pretty much it. I mean, we're waiting to see Washington finish off Pittsburgh now that they've got the series lead. And one hopes.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, with the Penguins, I mean, you know, it would be an interesting storyline to see them go at, you know, go at it against Las Vegas with their former goaltender, but still not interesting enough for me to want to see Pittsburgh back in the finals.
Oh no, I despise Malkin and Crosby. So that's all I have to say about them. You know, if it's going to be somebody from the East, let it be Tampa Bay. You know, listen, it was JT Miller who was cruelly traded, as far as I was concerned, from the Rangers. There was absolutely no cause for him to be shipped out in that trade day deadline deal. And he got the game-winning goal today, so good for him.
Yeah.
I'm happy for him. I'm happy to see that he, Ryan McDonagh, Dan Girardi, they all get to move on. So.
Now, probably the strangest bit of news that we got this week had to do with a company that for, oh, wow, 70-some-odd years now has been making the best electric guitars on the market. And all of a sudden, news came down that Gibson filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Now, I know a little bit about some of the machinations that have gone on behind the scenes because some of the guys that were in Gibson's front office are friends of mine. And I say were because they've been gone now for a little over a year. So there was a house cleaning and there were some things that I guess were going on that were not nefarious by any means. I mean, there wasn't anything weird going on at Gibson to the best of my knowledge, but they just made some business decisions over time that left them in the lurch as far as money and credit is concerned. And so they filed for Chapter 11 reorganization. Gibson isn't going anywhere. You'd be surprised how many people were thinking that this was Gibson going the way of Toys R Us and that they were going to, you know, start liquidating everything. That's not what's going on here. But still, it's a nasty knock, and it makes you wonder how much of this is just changing times and the changing face of music, in that, you know, guitar-driven bands are not what makes the top 40 anymore.
That and the fact that you and I have discussed this when the rumors were starting to really bubble and have substance is that, you know, Gibson's prices are ridiculous.
Right.
You know, the affordability of a Gibson guitar is extraordinary in comparison to a Fender or, you know, a Guild or some of the other, I guess in this case you call them reissue styles and brands like Eastwood, who does the reissues of the Airlines and so on. And, you know, Dan Electro and Silvertone, which you can get very good guitars at very low prices. But you know, people want Gibson. It's a classic name. Listen, more people buy Epiphones than they do Gibson.
Right. Well, and see, that's what I was just about to bring up, is the fact that you're absolutely correct in that the difference now is that a cheap guitar, when you and I were, you know, buying our really good ones, when we, you know, when we got into the 1980s and we started to really look around and see what was out there, a cheap guitar in the early 80s was crap. And even at that point, in fact, a lot of the top manufacturers were making garbage. However, it was at least higher quality garbage. And right now, the difference between you know, a $3,000 Gibson and a $300 or $400 Epiphone is not that much. You're not talking about a guitar in the Gibson that's going to be 10 times or 100 times better than the Epiphone.
Correct. All the difference is in the headstock.
Right.
That is seriously it. It's the same company and just the branding. And as an owner of Epiphones and Gibsons, you know, I love both. But my favorite guitar still happens to be my Epiphone Casino.
Right. Same here.
So, you know, well, we'll see what happens. I'm pretty sure Gibson will rebound. I think part of what helped bring them down to the state that they're in now is that whole retooling themselves from being Gibson Musical Instruments to being Gibson Products or whatever. You know, they were going for a broader lifestyle kind of audience to sell audio equipment to. No, just stick to what you know. Stick to what has been the success formula.
Right.
You know? It's called New Coke. Learn from that.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, yeah, there was a big push about 15 years ago to try to put a lot of the emphasis on the peripherals, on t-shirts and jackets and shit like that. And, you know, that stuff's nice, and everybody has that stuff. But if it's the core of your business, you need to rethink what the hell you're doing.
Exactly. which is the problem with most businesses.
Exactly. So we wish Gibson the best. Certainly, again, great musical instruments, great guitars, and would love to see them be a going concern into the future. But yeah, just one of those pieces of news we wanted to kick around a little while and see if we can figure out just what in the hell is going on. Speaking of what in the hell is going on, people I know who are not necessarily anywhere near as into music as you and I are were still given a bit of a shock this week when they heard that Rick Ocasek of The Cars and Paulina Poroskova, to whom he has been married since The Cars were writing all those great hit songs in the early 80s, they've split. It's been, what, 28 years that they were together?
28 years that they're married, and they've been together since 1984, so that's 34 years total.
Right. So, yeah, the statement they put out, it seemed like it was something as simple as just empty nest syndrome.
Yeah, that and the fact that, you know, when you watch the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Awards or the inductions and The Cars were nominated, there she is, standing right there cheering just as much as anybody else is. It seems to be an amicable split, but one you certainly didn't see coming. You know, and that's kind of – it always saddens me when you see these marriages of longevity suddenly end.
Yeah.
Because they seem like nice people. He's always seemed like a very, very nice guy.
Right.
So.
Right. And a guy who I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that he married up.
Yeah. And you know what? God love her for just loving the guy for who he is, you know, because – beautiful woman. She looks even better now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
When she was younger, I didn't pay that much attention when she was, you know, the it girl, but she's even more stunning.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I noticed something else this week, totally away from what we're talking about, but there's a movie coming out and it's one of these, older actresses who used to all be hot stuff when they were in their 20s and 30s who are now making a movie about being old. And Jane Fonda's in it, and I can't remember who the other two are, but the fourth one of the four who are in the movie is Mary Steenburgen. And I remember the first time I ever saw her was acting opposite Malcolm McDowell.
Time After Time?
Yes. And
she met him and married him.
Right, exactly. And they were married. They were also married for a good long time, although they split probably 20 years ago. But it was a great movie. And mm-hmm. I remember my dad talking about how sexy she was, and I did not get it. I was just like, well, sure, I guess. I mean, she's pretty enough. And I never understood it. And I saw some of the trailers for this movie. She has got to be close to 70, and she looks outstanding. She looks so much better now than she did when she was 25 or 30.
She had more of the cuteness and the sexiness rather than just the outward sexiness.
Right, right.
You know?
And now she just looks great.
You know, here's a perfect example. Shirley MacLaine, she got older. She went from being adorable to just being deadly sexy.
Right. I think she may be in this movie, as a matter of fact. She may be one of the other ones.
I mean, she's just a barking lunatic, but still, boy, oh boy, oh boy, you know, when – forget it. When she was in Sweet Charity, oh, for God's sakes. I mean, it would make me sit and watch that fucking movie just because of those legs.
Yep.
Never mind the fact that she was just smoking hot.
Nothing wrong with that at all. So, yeah. So, cheers to Mary Steenburgen.
Absolutely.
And a couple of other things that are happening. Oh, I guess we might as well just jump into the world of politics because there seems
that
to
be get out of the way. We purge ourselves and then we can enjoy the conversation again.
Exactly. We have to. Giuliani is back and now he's shooting his mouth off and saying stupid things, which shouldn't really come as a shock to anybody. And the wheels are coming off of this thing. The one thing I don't understand or don't know, I guess, about the Giuliani thing has it come to the point where Donald Trump's only option is to try to set up an appeal on the grounds of inadequate counsel? Because if ever there was inadequate counsel, it's the guy who goes on TV and says, yeah, he committed a couple of felonies. What? So I don't know if they're just trying to confuse everything by putting eight different narratives out there about any possible, you know, bit of minutia in this case, or if Giuliani is really that dumb.
I'm just going to go with the latter. I think I'll keep it simple. You know, I think Giuliani has lost any grip of reality, first of all.
Yeah.
And I'm not being facetious when I say that, because every time you've seen him in the last couple of years in a public speaking form, he says the most insane, illogical, irrational things.
Yeah, right.
And in the process, doesn't make sense either. I mean, there are people who can say insane things, but they're making sense. You know, they're delivering it in a manner that's understandable, even though it's completely wrong, abhorrent, psychotic, whatever.
Right.
It comes out sounding like rational thought. He's just babbling and babbling and babbling.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, you know, again, I don't know what they're paying Sarah Huckabee Sanders. It has got to be an ungodly amount of money for her to sit there and take that. And I believe me, I have no sympathy for her because she's brought this shit on herself by working for that idiot. But when Jim Acosta, I don't know if you heard it, a couple of days ago they were doing their briefing and Jim Acosta pulled out the L word because he said, look, you told us that there was no knowledge of the payment to Stormy Daniels. Now you're standing here telling us he did know about the payment to Stormy Daniels. So were you lying then, or were you just in the dark? And I thought, holy shit, he finally said, he actually said he said lying. And she tried to obfuscate and he wouldn't let her get away with it. And he said, look, were you lying then, or did you just not know what was going on? And the answer to that is she didn't know. They were keeping her deliberately in the dark. In fact, they were lying to her, and still she shows up to work every day.
Well, that's a good soldier. But then again, so is Eichmann.
Right.
And Himmler and Kaltenbrunner and Goering and Goebbels. Need I go on?
Yeah, right. And Heydrich. Of course, he was an asshole anyway, but...
Well, that's because he was a Jew.
I don't know. I can, you know, it's gotten to the point where it's not even good comedy anymore. It's just bad.
You're absolutely right. And the thing is, I don't want to even get into the realms of what calls itself comedy as far as the political cycle is concerned, because comedians right now just aren't funny. They've all been either neutered or they're just going off in such a way of making what is obvious not funny or satirical, you know?
Right.
You've got warring factions. You've got once funny people like Dennis Miller, who are completely staunchly militantly conservative / Republican, along with the very unfunny Roseanne Barr. And then you've got all the other idiots on the left who are just not funny because they're just busy telling you what the problem is and who the problem is and making fun of it. You're not coming up with the meat of what makes political comedy successful while being funny.
Right. There's no hook. There's no joke.
Right.
It's just aren't they stupid? Well, and yeah.
Make fun of them. No, no, no.
Right.
Guess what? That's called playground mentality. And I just, homie, don't play that.
Although, you know, I did have a revelation about something this week, and it has to do with the different ways that both sides are looking at politics right now. We'll get to that in a second, but I want to talk about the other side of the political spectrum here for a minute. Well, curiously, when you and I talked last time around, the questionnaire that Robert Mueller ostensibly had for Donald Trump had just hit the New York Times. They just broke the story. Hey, we've got this thing. And as it turned out over the course of the week, no, they didn't have anything. What they had was a bunch of questions that they effectively red teamed. And it was Jay Sekulow who wrote them. It was Trump's attorney who wrote that list of questions that appeared in the New York Times. And what they were doing was trying to say, okay, given the subjects that he's told us he's going to hit, what are the likely questions? But still, you know, it's a pretty extensive list, and at least now we know where Robert Mueller has told them he's going to spend most of his time concentrating.
Fair enough. The thing is, like they tend to do, the New York Times jumped the gun and painted a picture that is not what it was.
Right.
Which is so predictable of the New York Times. That's why whenever it says breaking news, I take no stock in it unless it's something that I already know as a fact. Case in point, what's his name winning the Kentucky Derby yesterday?
Oh yeah, who was it? I don't even remember.
Justify. Yes. You know, that's the only breaking news that has fact behind it, because the New York Times is possibly the biggest enemy of all of us because they're so fraudulent in the way they go about doing things. Them and their self-righteous, smug, fake left-wing way of things, with their propagandizing over certain elements and subjects, that it's very selective journalism that I find so distasteful.
Right. Right. But, I guess the odd part about that is you look at, again, where these names keep popping up. And the fact that Jay Sekulow has been the one name consistently as part of the Trump legal team. And don't forget, I mean, this is the guy who was Ralph Reed's bulldog attorney when Ralph Reed was still the head of the Christian Coalition. So, you know, again, you have to ask, okay, how many times does he have to kick you in the teeth? How many times does he have to be as non-Christian a person as you could possibly conceive of before you finally stand up for your own morality and walk away from this idiot?
Jay Sekulow?
Yeah.
That name sounds very, what's the word I'm looking for? How do I put this? He sounds like a Jew. And he's a lawyer.
Yeah.
Well.
But he did work for the Christian Coalition, so who knows?
He's a lawyer and a Jew, and they'll do anything for money. They'll work for anybody.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what to make of any of this anymore, except for the fact that, you know, again, this is the one case where the on many sides thing actually does come into play, because what do you have on the far, if that's the far right, and I'm not even convinced that it is, but if it is, what do you have on the far left? Oh, Jill Stein. What'd she do this week?
Quote unquote, well, the U.S. interferes in elections too. I'm going to preface what I'm about to say is, you know, we've discussed this off the air and on the air, and, you know, from my own perspective, while we have complete free reign of this show to say whatever we wish and express ourselves, because this is a podcast and it's an open forum for everybody and we cover all bases and we don't discriminate. But I've been trying to, you know, draw back a little bit more because I want to sound a little bit more professional and proper, even though this is, you know, just a conversation between two friends. But fuck you, you fucking cunt. I hate you, Jill Stein, and I wish you were arrested and your books looked into and that they throw you into the clink and you're never heard from again. I wish anybody who follows you to follow suit. All of you lemmings can go straight to hell. I think that's pretty much covers it.
Well, yeah, that does seem to cover the waterfront. But sure, I mean, look, over time, yes, we have done some absolutely miserable things as a country. The good thing about us is that when we do them, we tend to self-examine fairly well, and we do put the people who are responsible for them largely in prison, because in the heat of the moment, yes, we have made some ungodly awful mistakes. However, to say that we, you know, to make the intimation that somehow we do this as a going concern is exactly the same thing that Donald Trump said before the election about the Iraq War. And you know, to say something that is that kind of damaging and to pretend that, you know, you're still a part of some kind of Republican establishment, or even, you know, to try to paint yourself as the anti-establishment guy, it was shitty when he said it. And the thing is that you have to take intent into account. And the reason why the Russians screwed with our election is because they want nothing more than the downfall of the country. And when we have done it before, even as much as I disagree with it, you look at what we did with Chile in the early 1970s. And yeah, we should have left well enough alone. And yeah, we put in a guy who turned into a murderous dictator for 30 years. And that was a pretty stupid thing to do. But we didn't do it to try to knock over Chile. We did it to try to stop the communist threat from invading South America. There's a bit of a difference.
Well, Jill Stein is a communist. So therefore, anything that she says really needs to be taken with a grain of salt. And because she's so busy with her anti-American activities, I think our government would do a very good job into looking into making sure that she doesn't. Because anything that's done against the state is considered treasonous.
Right.
Much like lying to the government saying you didn't pay off a hooker.
Well, that's the point, though. If you're going to pretend that the other guy is Satan, stop acting like him. You know, it's the same thing that, who was it? Trey Gowdy, when he said a couple of weeks ago, he said, you know, to Donald Trump, he said, listen, if you're not guilty, stop acting like a guilty person.
That pot calling the kettle black.
Well, exactly. Right. And that's the point, is that, you know, if you're going to be that guy, if you're going to take him to task for being who he is, you cannot be like him. And that's what Jill Stein just cannot get through her thick skull. Now, it brings me to the thing that I wanted to say about the differences between the way people look at politics, because I got into an interesting discussion. Have you heard the Rosie O'Donnell story today?
I heard something in passing.
Okay. It's not, I was going to say it's not a big deal. It is, but Rosie O'Donnell, I guess, has admitted to, so I'm not saying, you know, I'm not using the word allegedly, but I guess I don't have to because she admitted it, that she over-donated to 5 Democratic candidates. And of the 5 Democratic candidates, the total amount, all told, you know, added together, that she over-donated was somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000. So about $1,000 each that she gave too much, because the limit's $2,700. And I saw something online about it today, and the right wing is going absolutely berserk, high-fiving each other, and woohoo, Rosie O'Donnell, and like, we got one. And they're shouting, of course, well, the thing is, you know, they're shouting, oh, lock her up, and all this stuff. And I saw this reference to Dinesh D'Souza, because apparently he also got busted for campaign finance violations. And I didn't know anything about the story, so I researched it. In D'Souza's case, he set up a bunch of shell straw men, you know, straw donors that didn't exist. And he gave to one candidate. He only did it for one candidate, but he over donated by $20,000 to one candidate in New York. So they're trying to make the connection, saying, well, if they're going to go to Dinesh D'Souza, they should throw Rosie in prison. Thing is, Dinesh D'Souza didn't go to prison. He went to a halfway house for 6 months and then went on probation. And the thing with Rosie O'Donnell is the way that they're looking at it is this will really hurt liberals. I know some liberals, and they couldn't possibly be moved to give a shit about Rosie O'Donnell.
I was about to say, the reason why you throw Rosie O'Donnell in jail is for being an annoying, unfunny asshole.
Exactly.
With a big mouth.
Right.
But that's 90% of all liberals at this point of the game. Who gives a shit if she gave a couple of, you know, $2,000? That's nothing. That's not a story.
Right.
As much as it pains me to say it. Now, if it was somebody like Jill Stein or Bernie Sanders doesn't contribute, he just takes your money. Sorry. you know, those are the people you want to see imprisoned.
Right. But you know, they were acting like they had just won the Super Bowl because they've got Rosie now. And I don't know that anyone cares.
Wow, that makes two of us, because I could give less than a fuck, and I'm not even a liberal.
Right, and my point was, okay, if it really makes you feel better to put Rosie in jail, go ahead.
Please do.
Sure, we'll fine, whatever.
I don't care, you know. While you're at it, you know, I can give you a list of names that I'd love to see go with her.
But see, right, exactly. But that's the point, is that I think they look at this, and this, when I say they, I don't mean Republicans. I mean these far-right Trump-supporting morons who are out there banging the drum. And it just underscores the idea that it's not about ideas, and it's not about politics, and it's not about any of that. It's about personalities. It's about cults of personality. And they got theirs. And, you know, if they can destroy one of yours, they think they scored a victory. But Rosie O'Donnell didn't belong to me.
Certainly not to me either. So, you know, then again, none of these people represent me in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Listen, even the musicians I've loved my whole life, what their politics are, what their personal beliefs are, I couldn't care less, because you know what? I may completely oppose them. So I don't want to not be able to distinguish the art from the artist.
Right.
And that's become way too much of the way it is now.
But it explains something. And this is, you know, again, it doesn't make it make sense, because it doesn't make sense. But I think it at least approaches explaining why what does a Trump supporter do? And you know the answer to this. When you show them he's making a fool of you, what do?
They attack you.
They don't attack you. They attack Hillary. And they attack Obama.
But they also turn on you, you know, and they try and dig up all the dirt that they can find on you just to make you look bad.
Right, right.
They always have, you know, it's that, again, going back to the playground mentality. Even for argument's sake, you say something to them that's an absolute truth that's been documented and eyewitnessed.
Right.
They will first deny, and then they will go on the rabid attack just to, deflect whatever the accusation may be, because they don't want to have to face the consequence of it.
Right. But, you know, I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because I like her, or, you know, because I thought, you know, that I had some kind of great affection for her. No, the reason I voted for Hillary Clinton was to try to avoid a disaster. That's the right. only reason I cast that vote. So the idea that when they say, well, you know, Hillary's never going to be president. No, you're right. And that's fine. You know, but it doesn't, you know, it hurts them when you attack their guy, because they think of it as a personal attack. And if somebody attacks Hillary Clinton and, you know, calls her nasty names and says she ought to be thrown in jail, I don't care.
Me either.
It doesn't hurt me.
And guess what else? If you want to get into the fact-based element behind it, yeah, there should be a jail cell waiting for her as well.
Right.
With all the shit that she's done.
Yep.
Vince Foster. Anybody remember him?
Yeah, and it just that's the whole point, is that it just that's why they think, you know, when they've got dirt on Rosie O'Donnell, that they've got something really cool. And it's like, no, I hate to break it to you, nobody cares.
Let's keep it really simple. We're going to refine it to the simplest elements there are. Okay, build that wall, lock her up,
right?
MAGA, fuck your feelings.
Exactly.
That's it. America, fuck yeah.
That's all they've got, and it's just so bloody sad. Now, away from all of that, because there's just no point in talking about it anymore.
Right, and I noticed that the lilt in our conversation this week, just from the get-go, by the way, is so much higher than it was last week because of the previous weeks, plural, of this political/social fatigue that we've all been snowed under.
Right.
This week it's a case of, okay, you know what? Fuck all of you.
Exactly. Absolutely accurate. So it's time to get into a little music talk, because there are some things going on that I think are of a fair amount of interest. And, you know, we've gone back and forth, I don't know, probably 100 times about groups that have reformed, sometimes in their original lineup, sometimes not, but at least close enough to it to call themselves the name of the original band. And we've got a couple of them who are at it this week.
One we don't need. No one was, I wasn't clamoring for this.
Yeah, who's getting back together that you're not going to be buying a ticket to?
NSYNC. Justin Timberlake does not need those guys, okay?
Right, right. And
he did Bad Teacher. He gets a plus in my book.
Uh-huh.
The thing of it, he was doing Cameron Diaz, so he gets a double plus in my book.
There you go.
So I don't hate him.
A nice twofer. But yeah, I don't know that anybody, even fans back in the day, were really clamoring for an NSYNC reunion, but I guess somebody must have been.
Well, look at it this way. Between the Backstreet Boys, Backstreet's back, all right, and new kooks on the block having done their summer reunion tour a couple of years ago to phenomenal success. God only knows why. It must have been the 40-plus MILF crowd
right.
going to see them. I guess NSYNC figured, well, we, with the exception of Justin, none of us are making much money, so help.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's like, let's make another Star Trek movie with the original cast. Why? Well, because somebody needs a boat. On the other hand, Flock of Seagulls also announced that they're reforming. And I have to be perfectly honest here. I'm like probably 95% of everybody else who lived through the 80s. I know one song. I feel like I should know more. I feel like Flock of Seagulls probably did something cool.
You know more songs than Iran. You know Space Age Love Song.
Oh, okay, all right, that's
you
two.
You know Telecommunication, you know Wishing, you know, If I Had a Photograph of You or Something to Remind Me. I wouldn't spend my life just wishing.
Right. Okay.
One, you know, you probably know things like Nightmares or It's Not Me Talking. You know all of those songs. I actually, there was one song that they had from the third album that got a lot of video play on the old U68. It was a song called "The More You The More You Live, The More You Love," which is probably one of the best things, if not the best song they'd ever done. After that, they were pretty much goners. But yeah, for some strange reason, and don't ask me why for sure, but the original lineup that did indeed bring us those songs that I just mentioned are releasing a new album. So what prompted this, I'm not sure. But you know what? There's been a plethora of these, quote, 80s bands that have done what a lot of bands from earlier generations, as you said, it's one or two of the people from the band, but they're trading under the name.
Yeah.
A group like ABC or Phil Oakey using the Human League's name, going out and performing. Haircut 100 actually reformed as themselves, the original lineup, including Nick Hayward, which that's great because I have no beefs with them. I love Nick Hayward. Lloyd Cole and the Commotions for a couple of gigs. That was something I wish they would have come here. But, A Flock of Seagulls to me will always be a band with hair, first and foremost. The image comes before the music, I hate to say.
Right. Well, you know what I would love to see, though?
Good.
Yeah. Well, you know what I would love to see, though, of all of those bands that have not yet gotten back together, simply because of what Stan Ridgway did in his solo career, which has been to become a very, very capable and interesting songwriter, is I would love to see what would happen if Wall of Voodoo got back together and sat down and started writing songs again.
They couldn't because Mark Morland and Joe Nannini are both dead.
Yeah, so true.
Fortunately, that the band that gave us, especially Call of the West,
yep,
can never be again. So that, unfortunately, is for the ages. As so many other bands are. I mean, there are certain bands that if somebody leaves, okay, maybe they can be replaced. But, and that's stretching it because to me, what makes a band special, right or wrong, this is just my opinion, having been in bands, what makes a band special is that lineup that you grow to know and love when they release those records that you take near and dear to your heart. And when the lineup changes, something is taken away. Somebody quits or somebody gets fired, whatever the case may be. It's not the same. It really is not the same. Number One Record is one of the most important and greatest albums of all time, but Radio City is a very different Big Star because
yeah.
Chris Bell isn't there.
Right.
The DBs will always be Peter Holsapple, Gene Holder, Will Rigby, and Chris Stamey. They gave us Stands for Decibels and especially Repercussion. As much as I love Like This, that's Peter Holsapple's DBs right there, because Chris Stamey had left the group. REM were never REM again after Bill Berry left. You could say what you will, even though he was the drummer, they lost something. They lost a part of them. They lost their soul, You take somebody out of a lineup and it's just never going to be the same. I mean, that Petrol Emotion just basically cut my heart out when John O'Neill left the band, after doing the End of the Millennium Psychosis Blues album in 1988. The Petrols were just never that band to me again.
Right.
It didn't work. So, there are some bands also when they go back and try again, and this is always the key foible. There was a great line that McCartney used to always use when people would ask him, about the Beatles getting back together again, even though he was at his heights with Wings. And he said, you can't reheat a souffle.
Yeah, right.
Peter talk about that and saying, well, you know, Paul McCartney always said, you can't reheat a souffle. Peter Tork very wisely and cleverly said, yeah, but spaghetti warms over really well.
There you go.
It's six of one, half dozen of the other. You know, look, it's a conversation you and I have had. It's a conversation I've had with many people. If the original lineup of the Punchline were to get back together, and I have to stress the original lineup because that's the lineup that put out the Wildflowers single, not the lineup that put out the To Get to the Other Side album, which is really the third recorded version. If the four-piece version of the Punchline were to get back together again, you know, A, I don't know how it would be, and I'm going to use the word chemistry, as much as I abhor it, you know, chemistry-wise, because it's been over 26 years since the four of us played together, albeit one time in 2003 for just a couple of hours at a dinner gathering. But, you know, for the four of us to pick up our old instruments, sometimes you can't, it's not, you have to be able to go in there with an idea of what is it you want to do first and foremost at that moment. Are you getting back together to do a reunion show? If that's the case, it's easier, I think, to be able to put yourself in the mindset of who you were then musically, so you can start to play those songs and revisit those songs. If you're getting back together with an eye on getting back together again and becoming a going concern once more, that's a very, very different kettle of fish.
Right. It's a different process entirely. A couple of things in the new music file we want to get to, and I've actually got one for you we did not talk about before yeah. our get together today, but I wanted you to start because there's a brand new album out from Vivian Leva. Let's start from start. Who's Vivian Leva?
She's a very young, and I'm saying very young, singer from the Appalachian Mountains who has, first of all, she sounds like she's, and this is, believe me, when I say complimentary, this is, you know, she sounds like she is someone who has been around for years and years. She's got one of those wonderfully seasoned, aged voices.
Fuming down in Asheville, fooling around us till dawn. I've been tossing, turning, restless all night long. You've been trying to tell me no one knows what the years will bring. I've been trying to tell you time is everything. When we've been to the east and we've been all over the west, past towns of broken memories, faded love and words I wished you'd never said.
And she is a terrific songwriter with a great deal of feel and, you know, in her delivery, and a complete, first of all, her album is, it's her first album. It's called Time is Everything. She has a complete understanding, comprehension, and absorption of true American roots music. So I don't want to use the A word here because she is of those physical lands. She grew up in that landscape where that music is made. So it's pure. And that's what's so wonderful about this record. It is a stunning, stellar debut. She has a great voice. She has a great knack for melody. She's another one of those singers who knows how to deliver the right emotion for the song, what makes the song work. You know, there's this one song called Every Goodbye, which is a ballad. And she sings it very quietly. And it's either just, I can't really tell, but that's fine. Either way, it's either a mandolin or a muted banjo in the background.
Okay.
You know, but her voice carries along with the melody that gives you chills. You know, it's a lot of pure, beautiful, happy, joyful bluegrass, real, deep, rich American music. It's an album I absolutely enjoyed from the moment I put it on.
Does she have a lot to say? Because as you said, she is very young.
You know, in the context of these songs, because they're about feelings, I would say they have enough understanding and perspective of the world around her at this age that she's very mature.
So there's a universality to it.
Yes.
All right. Yes, great. Indeed. Timing is Everything is a new one, and you can find the review, of course, elsewhere on popdose.com. And what I have for you, and I know you're going to laugh at me when I tell you this, but had a conversation this week with, of all people, Derek Smalls, the bass player from Spinal Tap, and he's got a new album out. Say again?
And the Thamesman.
Yes, of course, and the Thamesman. And he's got a brand new album out. It's a solo album, his very first ever solo album. It's called Smalls Change. And it's outstanding. Smalls Change, and the subtitle of the album is Observations on Aging. And what you have in this album is you have an aging rocker who is going through every change you could possibly imagine. I mean, there's a song on here called Memo to Willie, which for anyone who's ever taken a Viagra pill because they needed one, you know what this song is about. But there's a lot more to it than that. And he goes through, in fact, the title track on the song Smalls Change is about missing his bandmates, about doing an album without the rest of Spinal Tap. And it's really kind of touching. There's a lot of humor in it, as you might imagine. And of course, there's one scathing rebuke in a song called Faith No More, which is written directly to their former manager, Ian Faith, who absconded with all their royalties.
The gift of gab and gabardine has landed on the show. He stood so tall, now he skitters round just like a stone angel. You never know what's inside until you lift the lid. When you start to stop believing, it's like you never did.
So he just gets the biggest slap on this album. But the songs themselves are really fantastic. I mean,
well, let me ask you a question. Since you're saying these are very personal songs, does he at least take a pot shot at that tarot reading witch? Who is, I think, either the girlfriend or wife of said former guitarist Nigel Tufnell?
I don't know if it may be more of an oblique hit than it was in the Faith No More song, but still, yeah, there's a lot of... I don't want to make it sound like the album is a score-settling album, because it isn't. It really is just what Derek Smalls is going through as he gets older. And, you know, he did not... In the conversation that we had this week, he did not close the door on the possibility of working with his mates from Spinal Tap again. So that's out there, but this album is very much his own, and it's not, I think it's a much more musically mature album than the last couple that we got from Spinal Tap.
Like Smell the Glove or Shark Sandwich. Yeah. You know, the two-word review of Shark Sandwich, shit sandwich.
Yes. Right. So this is, I mean, it's a fully fleshed out, full length, very, very capable effort from Derek Smalls. And I think that, yeah, I mean, when you look at the number of people that he brought in to be a part of this, including but not limited to names like Don Henley, Donald Fagen, David Crosby. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. In fact, Steve Lukather plays guitars on a bunch of these tracks. It's amazing. The work that they put together on this is just fantastic.
Interesting. It's a lot of the Laurel Canyon scene playing with an old metalhead.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you know what? And that comes through, because I think that's where that sort of musical maturity that shows through on this album comes from, is the fact that you do have those guys who have a much more sort of folk rock sensibility working alongside a guy who's just, he's got a lot to say at this point in his career. And I think that given the chance to step out and be in the forefront, you know, not behind Nigel and the rest, is something that Derek Smalls really, I mean, it should have happened a long time ago.
Well, that's because he was always stuck in a Perspex bubble. He's also, yeah, that doesn't help.
I was hoping he was going to get out of that in time for the interview. Yeah.
Well, there you go. By the way, folks, total disclaimer, what John and I were just doing was actually a parody kind of record review, because Derek Smalls is in fact played by Harry Shearer.
Yes.
Comedian, raconteur, former Saturday Night Live alum. And, of course, Derek Smalls is the bass player of the fictional rock group Spinal Tap, as depicted in the 1984 rockumentary This Is Spinal Tap, directed by that lefty lunatic Rob Reiner.
Right. Yeah, but I will say, everything that I just said about that album, I truly believe that was not hyperbole. It's great stuff.
Well, it's no different than listening to the Ruddles. I mean, of course, we've, you know, punctured that myth millions of times, but at the end of the day, you can listen to both, you know, the Ruddles album, the quote soundtrack to All You Need Is Cash.
Yep.
And Archaeology.
Right.
Because Neil Innes is an incredibly gifted songwriter, period.
Right. And, you know, you also have Eric Idle is no slouch as a musician.
Even though he actually did not play on the Ruddles recordings. He did perform with them when they got back together a couple of times in the last few years, but he was not on the recorded songs, and that's what most people don't realize. It was Ali Halsall, who is no longer with us. He was a member of the band Pato, along with John Halsey, who played Barry Wom, or Barrington Womble,
yep,
because I'm trying to save time and Brill Cream to save his hairstyle. what do you call it? He was actually the one who did the McCartney, but he did the Dirk McQuickley bits.
Right.
Whereas Neil Innes did the Ron Nasty bits. So they had it very cleanly divided, and Ali Halsall was an incredibly gifted guitarist and bass player. And so he played bass on the Ruddles records. He was, in fact, for a moment in the Ruddles legacy as Leppo, the fifth Ruddle.
Right.
Who accompanied them to Germany, but fell into a packing case with a rather large-breasted German Fräulein and was never heard from again. He stood at the back and didn't know how to place, but in Germany that didn't matter as long as he knew how to have a good time.
Right. Oh, man, too much. But, yeah, it really is. I mean, get a copy of Small's Change. You'll enjoy it, or at least sample some of it, and you can make your own decisions from there. We do have a couple of more things before we get to In Our Heads, not the least of which is this week's sad farewell, because here's a guy again in Tony Kinman who died young, at age 63, and had given us so much great music over time. You know, it's interesting when you go back and look at who somebody is associated with. We'll get to that part of it, but for people who don't know the legacy, who is Tony Kinman?
Tony Kinman was the bass player and bass voice, if you will, first of the very legendary band The Dills, the punk band, punk,
yep,
trio that he formed with his brother Chip. They went on then to form a band that I just absolutely loved. Love will always love. The first, quote, cowpunk band, as most everybody called them. Really, the guys who were the forward thinkers when it came to the whole, the whole cowpunk movement that later exploded, Rank and File. Then after Rank and File had come to an end, they formed a duo called Blackbird, which was this interesting, almost electronic thing that they had done. And then one last project together called Cowboy Outfit. But the thing about Tony Kinman's passing, I mean, it's very personal for me because, you know, I was such a big fan of, I mean, I like The Dills, but I loved Rank and File. I loved what they were doing. I loved the sound, where they were going. I loved their vocals. I loved the song structures. I mean, for God's sakes, the Everly Brothers covered them, you know,
yeah,
on their album Born Yesterday. They did Amanda Ruth, which is on the first Rank and File album. There was just something about that band that came along that hit me the right way at the right moment. And what's so upsetting about this is that it was very sudden. He'd been diagnosed with cancer, and they thought nothing of it, that it was treatable, but it turned out to be violently aggressive, and it was very quick downhill, because all of a sudden word was that he was in hospice and that he didn't want to stay there. He just wanted to go home and have it end.
Yeah.
And it was only a matter of days. And it really was a very upsetting thing that you know, a lot of us are trying to absorb it still.
Right. And as you said, I mean, a lot of the music that he made later on in his career is much more what he's remembered for. But still, I mean, when it comes to The Dills, for me, as just an in and out, let's make a punk rock song and kick its ass, it doesn't get better than Clash. Back for in New York and LA.
True. Very true. Well, the thing was, they were also of that right age to be a punk band. You look at them, they don't look formulaically punk like everybody else seemed to do. They didn't wear a uniform.
Right.
They just went out there and they played very aggressively, but they also had very smart lyrics. So these guys were no dummies.
Yeah.
And right. Tony Kamen was also a guy, and Chip is the same, you know, because Chip, I'm happy to say that the last thing that Chip has done thus far is Ford Maddox Ford, which is his new band, and he considered it as a kind of blues punk, and it's produced by Tony. So at least Tony is there in spirit as well as the actual production of this record. But, you know, the thing is, they showed an incredible sense of all-around musical spectrum by creating rank and file, because they were so ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
And I know, and I remember there were some people that said, this is bullshit, but it wasn't. It was fantastic because it was different. You know, the thing is, punk, when it wore off, left you kind of naked. Like, where do I go now? You know, do I turn metal? No, I don't think so. What did I grow up with? What music works for me? What still touches me? I'm getting too old to play punk. Not just play the physical music, but to play the role of punk.
Right.
You know? They were smart enough to move on. And to their credit, also, they never reformed the Dills either, even though they'd been offered tons of money. You know, it was always a case of going forward and never looking back.
Yeah, right, exactly, and that's what music is supposed to be. So again, a sad farewell to Tony Kamen of the Dills and Rank and File and so many other great acts that he was a part of and that he touched. So 63, far too young. So we'll bring it back up with one last thing before we hit in our heads, because once again, one of your fellows at Pop Dose, Ken Shane, has knocked it out of the park. And, you know, it's funny, with so many of his Soul Serenade columns, they have been about legendary bands with a hit that either has been forgotten or for too long has been sort of shoved aside because they had other massive hits. And in this case, he goes back to a band that is that, you know, a band that should have been exactly what their name implies. And yet too often they find themselves not necessarily forgotten, but at least shoved to kind of the back of the crowd, because the foundations were just fantastic. So where does Ken take us in the Soul Serenade?
He gives you a bit of a deeper background on a band that very few people, unfortunately, remember and know much about. Baby, Now That I Found You is one of my favorite songs of all time. So, you know, every time I hear it, up goes the volume very, yep, very high so I can belt it out along with it. You know, it's one of the greatest, most joyful, boisterous songs I have ever heard. The production is out of this world. You know, this is 1967, 68 we're talking about. Just fantastic. You know, it was a band of both black and white players, an English band, that really knew how to give Americans the run for their soul and money. Spend our lifetime looking for somebody to give me love like you. Now you told me that you wanna leave me. Darling, I just can't let you. Baby, now that I found you, I can't let you go. Now that I'm around you, I need you so. Baby, I could have seen this on Stax. I can easily imagine this having been on that yellow label with the finger snap, because it's from that period. However, they were signed to Uni Records, which of course later was absorbed into MCA. But that was their first single. Right out of the box, they had a smash the whole world over. They released a follow-up single, and it didn't go anywhere, unfortunately. It was what was it called? Back on My Feet Again. Not a bad song by any stretch of the imagination. Not dissimilar to Baby Now That I Found You, which was very much, you know, it was the recipe of the day to do a follow-up release that sounded almost like your first hit.
Yeah.
To keep that interest there. Nobody really dug it. They had some problems with a few band members who'd quit, started to get frustrated, changed lead singers, and then they came back with an even bigger hit in Build Me Up Buttercup. Then they lost their main songwriters, who got into management arguments, and you know, and all of a sudden, really the rug was pulled out from under them. But the main thing is that Baby Now That I Found You is a song that it's now, what, 50 years old?
Yep.
That is one of the greatest, most timeless songs ever. Period. I mean, you know, you throw it up there with a song like Everybody's Talking, or Judy in Disguise with Glasses, or Walk, Don't Run. You know, something that you hear on the radio that makes you feel good. It might bring you back to a different time. It brings you back to a different mindset, but it fills you with joy. And I'm just glad of the fact that Ken was able to share this song with an audience that I'm sure never heard it.
Right. Well, and one of the things that I always thought was cool about them is that where you had the, you know, the British invasion stuff that was still, by 67, it was starting to wane some, but they still owned the pop charts. But the reason why that happened is because it didn't sound like the American pop of the day did. Where with the Foundations, like you said, this would have been right at home on Stax. It fit. It fit the genre. They did it really well. But they didn't sound like a British soul band. They sounded like a soul band.
Right. They had a, that song has a feel to it.
Yep.
Well, first of all, like I said, the key word is that it's boisterous, because it really is. It just leaps out of the certainly the car speakers, because it was a single. So it had that bigger, fatter, you know, deeper rhythm section sound. But it had that big brass punchy opening with that the piano notes. That, so it's a very heavy laid piano, bass, drums opening that starts that do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Also a very simple melody.
Right.
That's immediately sing-alongable, you know?
Yep. Yeah, it's great stuff. The brass comes
in and everybody starts singing, and it's just such a catchy thing. I mean, really. What a wonderful song to have a chance to talk about.
It's a house of fire, no doubt about it. And thanks again to Ken Shane for doing the yeoman's work and bringing it back forward.
So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, check out the column. And with that, we do indeed get to In Our Heads. And I know you warned us last week that this one was going to be all yours, Rob Ross. So by all means, take it away, sir.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I mean, usually you come up with In Our Heads in the afternoon just before we do our show. But there were a couple of things that had been burbling in my head. And actually a conversation that had been sparked by my wife when she mentioned, have you noticed, and then I sat down and I started to think about it, have you noticed recently, let's say in the last, I'll say 8 to 10 years or so, it may be a little further than that, but songs have now become these mournful piano dirges.
Yeah.
There's these really irritating cover versions of what usually are new wave period, quote, classics, that are turned into these piano dirges. And I was wondering, are there any that stand out to you as being really good and also abhorrently bad?
Wow. Well, first of all, let's back up a step here, because I think there's a reason why that's happening. And the reason why it's happening is because it works well in the context of television. And what they're doing with a lot of those songs is they're taking them and they're putting them on a soundtrack of some TV show. You know, it'll show up at the end of a TV show. And as a matter of fact, I heard one the other night and it was god awful. And I wish I could remember what it was. You got me on the spot with this one. But as it was playing, I thought, is that really? It was akin to taking 99 Luftballons and turning it into a piano dirge. It was like, oh my god, this is horrible.
I have to say, this all started not just from the conversation that I had with her, but the fact that when HBO was going on their blitz of promoting the upcoming and now on season of Westworld, I kept hearing these notes, and I'm like, what is that? That's so familiar. And then I realized it was this funereal, sludgy piano version of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box, and I was like, ah, it's insufferable.
Thank you. it wasn't a great song to begin with.
Right. And then I started to think about some of these others. And she brought it up. So I guess we were thinking the same thing independently of one another. Because there are some that I didn't even know existed. And then I heard one the other day that I thought, wow.
What was good?
Okay, this one's really, really left field. It's a fellow named Todd Terje, T-E-R-J-E, and he's singing and playing piano, and he's joined by, of all people, Brian Ferry for a version of Robert Palmer's Johnny and Mary.
Johnny says he's willing to learn when he decides he's a fool. Johnny says he lives anywhere.
It definitely did work, and that's what was so stunning. But it was even more stunning because I had this conversation with you planned. You know, it was already in mind. And I only heard this on, I think it was either Thursday or Friday.
Yeah, boy, it's killing me now because I really wish I could remember that awful one that was on. It was within the last couple of days, and I thought, that can't be what I'm hearing. And then the vocal started, and I thought, and it was a female vocalist singing what was originally a male vocalist song, which is fine, but just the way that she was doing it, the treatment it was given was so poor. But I'm with you. I'm with you and your wife on this one. I can't stand it 99% of the time when something like that is done.
Well, I remember when Tori Amos did an album of covers because I think it was her contractual obligation album with Atlantic Records when I was working there. And it was called Strange Little Girls. And she just massacred Strange Little Girl by The Stranglers and Rattlesnakes by Lloyd Cole. It was just unpardonable. It was a sin. But I think this all started with, I'm sure you've seen the movie, it was that movie with Jake Gyllenhaal with the that evil bunny that he used to hallucinate.
Right, yeah, Donnie Darko.
Yeah, the song, the cover of Tears for Fears' Mad World, that was the song I think that really started this whole kind of trend.
Yeah, right. And there's, you know, I've actually seen a couple of them happen on Saturday Night Live as well. And I, you know, again, I wish I could throw in more on this because I'm having trouble pulling names of songs up. But yeah, I know there have been some really heinous ones, and I don't know why. I mean, that idea of taking some, there are good songs now that have that same sort of feel to them, that real melancholy kind of, you know, you can end up a nice, you know, sad TV episode with this. As a matter of fact, let me go off in a different direction, and I will give you one that I really loved because, first, I loved the song from the first time I heard it. And sometimes when there is one of those out there and you see it as part of a TV show you like, it makes it even better. I was watching House one night back in, you know, when it was still in first run, so maybe 7-8 years ago, and there was one particular, you know, he was hitting another crisis point and he just got on his motorcycle and rode away. And as he was riding away, they started playing a song by Michael Penn called Walter Reed. And it fit perfectly.
All I wanna do is hide. It's graduation day. Everything I learned inside didn't seem to pay. I've had my fill of palm trees and lighting up Grandma's Chinese. Tell me now, what more do you need? Take me to Walter Reed tonight. Baby, I lost the will for fighting over everything.
And I thought, you know, if you're going to take a song like that, first of all, that, you know, not a lot of people have heard or are familiar with, and you know, find the exact perfect moment for it, that's the one they really nailed.
Did they use the actual song, or did they use somebody covering?
No, it was Michael Penn. Yeah, they used the one from the album. From, I think it's called Palms and Runes, Tarot and Tea.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the thing is with these covers, it seems to be these people who are just so far-reaching. I mean, I didn't hate the Gary Jules version of Mad World.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's everything that comes afterwards. Like somebody doing Love Will Tear Us Apart on a piano. It doesn't work, you know. Like you said, Heart Shaped Box is a lousy song to begin with, you know. But to hear, you know, this piano, you know, playing the hey, wait part, you know, that you know, where it starts and stops, you know. And, you know, and then you've got that do-do-do-do-do-do-do being played by cellos. Oh, it's just so pompous.
Yes. Yeah, that needs to stop. Well, like I said, I wish I could have thrown more in, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to take my own advice. I'm going to find out what that song was and leave it in the comments section at the bottom of the page.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. You sent me that Goober piece thing, and I... You're lucky I even showed up for this week's show, sir. Let me just tell you.
Yeah, but you know what I was for? That song was great.
That was just so... I mean, my God. All I needed was to see, you know... What was it? Cartman Lee marching around with a Confederate flag.
Yes, oh, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you know? Respect my authority.
Well, Rob Ross, we will... why not leave it with a Cartman impersonation? We will leave it until next week, my friend, and we'll have some more interesting things, I'm sure, happen over the course of the next 7 days.
Of course.
I got a call coming in. I don't even know who that is.
Hang on, people, don't interrupt us. We're doing a show here.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know why that's happening. 573.
It's probably a robocall.
Yeah. That's mid-Missouri. Well, listen, we will leave it till next time, my man. Have yourself a wonderful week, and just enjoy yourself, man. Keep your head down and hope the Mets get better.
Yeah, you know what? It's only baseball. I don't get paid to play it. I always remember that at the end of the day. And you know what? Just for laughs, see if you can find some of these piano covers out there and see what may be palatable versus reprehensible. And we can do like a compare and contrast next week.
You got it.
All right, brother. Have a great week. I'll talk to you soon.
Peace.